Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the headlines, but who aren't necessarily politics experts. Perhaps you don't have time to keep up with the gazillionth Partygate scandal that has trickled out from Downing Street. I wouldn't blame you because there's literally been like 16 at least now. Even I am losing count, but today I am going to talk you through all of it and all the ramifications and so on. I'm Julia Bell and I've missed you. I've missed this. It's been a mad start to the year for me, so I haven't been able to just sit down and talk to you. So thank God I'm able to do that here. And what a better way to kick off 2022 than to carry on this year as we ended last year, to chew over Boris Johnson's ever more precarious position at the top of the Conservative Party totem pole. Now, perhaps you listened to this podcast back in December. I did an episode about the fallout from this leaked Allegra Stratton video. Remember, the Downing Street kind of press worker turned advisor who was very infamously joking about this quote unquote business meeting with wine and cheese that was meant to have taken place on the 18th of December 2020, when of course we were all absolutely not allowed to be having anything close to a party whatsoever. And that, I mean, I'm just remembering my mindset at the time. That was such a huge controversy. The very idea that staff in Downing Street might have had a bit of a social get together in Christmas 2020 when we'd all had our Christmases, I mean, cancelled, really. I was not a happy bunny when I recorded that episode. But here we are in January and we're now looking, like I say, at least 16 separate alleged rule-breaking parties and gatherings in Downing Street. So my, you know, not a happy bunny status has just kind of descended into a relative numbness at this point, I have to be honest. But the 16 that we're thinking about range from the 10th of May 2020, the 15th of May, 20th of May, 17th of July. Should I just read all of these? Should I just read you all the dates? And then what you can do is you can flick back in your own calendar from that time. I imagine it would be rather barren from this time of year. And you can work out what you were doing on these days. So yeah, 5th of November, 13th of November, these are all 2020, 27th of November, 2nd of December, 10th of December, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th of December, 2020. And now, of course, more recent revelations show that perhaps more took place on the 12th of April, 2021 and the 16th of April, 2021. Now look, whether you're in the camp that is a little bit more kind of live and let live, you know, the idea of a prime ministerial resignation would be somewhat blowing this out of proportion. Maybe you think that, or maybe you're of the mindset that, you know, bottom line, those who set the rules should be sticking to them, and so should their staff be, and that therefore it's time for Boris Johnson to go. Wherever you sit in this argument, what I will say is that Boris Johnson potentially not being prime minister anymore is now a real conversation. While it has just been a kind of outlet for people to moan about him in the past, I would say, now it's real, because there are Conservative MPs who are, as we speak, writing or considering writing letters to trigger a vote of no confidence. Will it happen? Not necessarily. This is all hypothetical at this point, but there are people trying to get those wheels in motion. Why? Because their inboxes are overflowing with extremely angry emails from constituents who are demanding that it's the PM's time to go. You know, those inboxes have fluctuated depending on how angry people are, but these are record levels now that seem to be tipping some Conservative MPs over the edge. So in this episode, I will run you through what brought us here, and I'll also explain how a vote of no confidence and how ousting a prime minister would actually work, because I think it's good for you to know that in case, and it's a very big in case, we actually do see it in action. So before I get into all of that juiciness, please make sure you have subscribed to this podcast so you never miss an episode. I appreciate that my upload schedule lately has been rather erratic, so this will make sure that you always catch them. And you can now rate the podcast on Apple, but also now on Spotify. So click the full 5 stars, won't you? And that way, more and more people can discover me and get involved with this conversation and feel invited to the table, is the way I like to put it. That would mean the world. Thank you in advance. And with that sorted, let's get into this. Right, so why are at least a few Conservative MPs turning their backs on Boris Johnson? I say a few because the number fluctuates. I can't actually be specific about this. It totally depends on what paper you read, actually, because today's iPaper, I'm recording this on Monday, the 17th of January, they've said that the number of Tories has passed 20 who are going against Boris Johnson and kind of putting the wheels in motion for him to step down. But then today's Guardian says, quote, there have been reports that up to 35 are writing to trigger a vote of no confidence. So maybe it's somewhere between 20 and 35. Maybe that number has increased even more since these papers were published. But either way, however many it is, the question I want to look at is why are more and more people seemingly changing their minds about the Prime Minister? And I think a lot of it is rooted in the fact that there were these photographs leaked of the Prime Minister himself at what looked very much like a garden party. I mean, it's scarily similar to my own anecdotal experiences of a garden party. So he's round the back of Downing Street. It's dated the 20th of May, 2020. So they're in the Downing Street garden. And if you can remember, the 20th of May, 2020, look at your calendar. I'm telling you, it'll be empty because the rules were you're only allowed to meet one other person that you don't live with and it has to be outside. So it was the kind of time where, you know, you were maybe going for a socially distanced walk for 40 minutes with a neighbour. This was the extent of our kind of party lifestyle at that time. In the photo, I mean, feel free to whack it up on your phone so I can talk you through it and you can look at it at the same time. He is sitting at an outdoor table with his now wife, Carrie Johnson, I think their baby too, and his former advisor, who he employed at the time, Dominic Cummings, a favourite name on this podcast, plus another aide as well. And there is wine on the table. You can see the wine, you can see the chatting. It doesn't look much like a meeting. It looks more like they're sort of chilling and having a glass of wine. But in the background, there is quite a big group of people who are gathered around a table of what looks to be, you know, just a table full of bottles. I will say it doesn't look like a rager. It just looks like people in their work gear, maybe with their top button undone, having a beer. And we've got to remember the fact that Boris Johnson does live at Downing Street. So it's a bit more complicated because technically he could say, well, I'm just having a glass of wine in my bloody garden, which was allowed by everybody at that time, if they were lucky enough to have gardens. So that bit's fine. But the issue remains, clearly there is socialising and drinking going on in the background of Boris Johnson sitting at this table with his now wife. And these people in the background clearly do not live at Downing Street. They don't live with each other, presumably, because there's like 15 of them. And Johnson is right in the foreground, which is all the evidence you need of him sanctioning this social event. Now, you might say, hang on, if all of these people in the background are working nonstop, it's May 2020, they're all pretty much broken at this point because of how stressful their jobs are, and it's a, you know, it's a sunny afternoon, it's a gorgeous day, it's the end of the workday, and they're just taking a little break, and they happen to have a beer in their hands at that time, and they're taking their break outside, that's safer for COVID, come on, is this really the end of the world? That's your decision to make. But I will refute the idea that they were just all coincidentally gathered in the garden at the same time and it could be passed as a meeting, because a specific email from Number 10 official Martin Reynolds has been leaked from that day where he invited more than 100 Downing Street staff to a party in the garden. So this was a very intentional collection of people socialising. This is what he wrote, because we can access this email. Quote, hi all, after what's been an incredibly busy period, we thought it'd be nice to make the most of this lovely weather and have some socially distanced drinks in the Number 10 garden this evening. I will repeat again, at this time, considering what the rules were, you know, socially distanced drinks in a private garden amongst 100 people is breaking the rules. Point blank period. There's no way to interpret that email outside of it being an invitation to break the rules. That's just a fact, I'm afraid. In fact, the government knew in advance that this weather, this beautiful weather, I'm sure you can remember if you were here in the UK, they could see in the weather forecast that that would be a threat to tempting people to go out and break the rules. So that very week, this is what Matt Hancock said to intentionally preempt that. Listen to this.
This weekend, with the good weather and the new rules, I hope people can enjoy being outside. But please, Stick with the rules, keep an eye on your family, and don't take risks.
Matt Hancock there on the 15th of May, warning us to abide by the rules despite the temptation that beautiful weather brings. And this is the very same beautiful weather system, it's the same period of time that he's warning us about, that number 10 official Martin Reynolds was actively encouraging 100 Downing Street employees to quote-unquote make the most of. So, how did Boris Johnson respond to these photographs? Well, he did something that he doesn't do super often. He apologised. His wording of that apology received a mixed reception, but you can make your own mind up. Here it is.
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologise. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months. I know the anguish that they have been through, and I know the rage they feel with me and with the government I lead when they think that in Downing Street itself, the rules are not being properly followed by the people who make the rules. Number 10 is a big department with the garden as an extension of the office, which has been in constant use because of the role of fresh air in stopping the virus. And when I went into that garden just after six on the 20th of May, 2020, to thank groups of staff before going back into my office 25 minutes later to continue working, I believed implicitly that this was a work event. But Mr. Speaker, with hindsight, I should have sent everyone back inside, and I should have recognised that even if it could be said technically to fall within the guidance, there would be millions and millions of people who simply would not see it that way.
That was Boris Johnson apologising on the 12th of January, 2022. So bear in mind just the timelines here. The photograph was taken from the 20th of May, 2020. But because it's only come out recently, Boris Johnson was apologising this week. And as you heard, it is a sorry. You got a sorry. You got an apology. But then it's also a sort of, I didn't do anything really that wrong. And yes, I'll take ownership, but at the same time, it's up to the inquiry to decide whether I really need to take ownership. You know, it's a sorry, not sorry, but also kind of sorry, but not really. Now, to make matters worse, following that apology in the Commons, the Telegraph newspaper broke a story of yet more rule-breaking gatherings, this time in April 2021, one of which was supposed to have taken place on the 16th of April, which was the eve of Prince Philip's funeral. And all I can think about is that harrowing photograph of the Queen. Do you remember this? It's just horrible to look at. I think seeing anyone in a state of mourning is just awful, but then seeing them go through it during lockdown when they can't have their family around them, it makes it worse. And the Queen was humanised significantly in this particular photograph because she was sitting there in the black dress with the black mask on a whole pew on her own. And COVID guidelines at the time banned indoor mixing, so that's why. So then to hear reports of what's meant to have been a leaving party for the PM's then Director of Communications, a man called James Slack, where staff were reportedly sent to a shop nearby, I think it was a co-op nearby, to stash a suitcase full of bottles of wine. And then we hear reports of music and a quote-unquote party atmosphere continuing past midnight. To hear that happened on the evening and then the next day you had the Queen sitting alone at her own husband's funeral. However you look at this topic, that is not a good look. And look, you're still within your rights to say, oh, so what? Boris Johnson, by all accounts, wasn't at this April gathering, so the one on the eve of Prince Philip's funeral. So why should he take all the flack for it? And I do think that's a good point. But a lot of the anger comes down to people remembering how vehemently Johnson denied any rule breaking ever. Do you remember? Literally a month ago, when I did the episode about the Allegra Stratton video, Johnson said he was quote-unquote furious about that.
I was also furious to see that clip. And Mr. Speaker, I apologise. I apologise unreservedly for the offence that it has caused up and down the country, and I apologise for the impression that it gives. But I repeat, Mr. Speaker, that I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party and that no COVID rules were broken, and that is what I have been repeatedly assured.
So bearing that utter denial in mind, moving forward to now where we are in a place where there are at least 16 different alleged parties happening in this man's house, it starts to feel like he would have to have been seriously visually impaired, audibly impaired, and just sensorially impaired not to have known about any of these events at all. So you do start to think to yourself, I wish you hadn't denied this so aggressively, and then we might have been in a different place. You might not have attended everything, but I wish you hadn't denied it so much. Okay, let's talk about where we are now. A civil servant by the name of Sue Gray is investigating everything about this Partygate stuff. So what happened, when, who was in attendance, and most importantly of all, whether it constitutes a rule break, or breaking the law, a criminal offence. And so far, Johnson has, I would say, quite enjoyed having this report as a way of avoiding questions. You know, it's nice to be able to say, look, I'm not going to answer that question because there's no point doing that until we've got the findings of this report. So it's been nice. And that's why I, for one, am very much looking forward to it being published so we can start getting into it. Now, critics are saying, why do we need a civil servant to tell us what we are looking at with our own eyes? These are photographs of social gatherings, which evidence the fact that Downing Street staff did not abide by the rules. But the hope for Boris Johnson's allies is that this report will say, look, these could be deemed as work events. Yes, it's slightly grey, but there was nothing at the time to say you couldn't be drinking a glass of wine and, you know, moving between your desk and the garden. There's nothing to say that a working environment couldn't have music. And these people were essential workers, so they did need to be there. And there's nothing to say they couldn't, you know, talk to each other from afar outside or have their meetings outside. You know, basically, to be blunt, the hope is they'll get out on a technicality. That's just me being totally straight up. And Boris Johnson does very emphatically say he doesn't believe he's done anything particularly wrong. I think a lot rides on this report in terms of how many Conservative MPs will be willing to gang up on Boris Johnson and oust him. But either way, I want to get you squared away on what the actual process is for ousting a Prime Minister. You might be familiar with it already because, as my dad beautifully put it the other day, the Tories love nothing more than a bit of good old-fashioned regicide. There is a pattern here of the Conservatives, you know, enjoying someone's position in the top spot for a bit and then going, OK, you've had your moment, off you pop. Because it was literally only 2019 where they held a vote of no confidence in the then Prime Minister, Theresa May, amidst the mess of Brexit negotiations. She did actually survive that, but it wasn't long before the threat of another vote of no confidence cropped up and she just stepped aside and said, I can't do this anymore. And that made space for Boris Johnson to step up, as we know. So here we are again, the Tories' favourite hobby. We're back having this conversation. So the way it works is there's this committee in the Conservative Party called the 1922 Committee. You'll probably have heard of this because it's been in the news a bunch. And the 1922 Committee is made up of backbenchers, right? So you're not in that. These are not people who are in the cabinet, who are on the front bench, who run this committee. But they still have a lot of power because, remember, backbenchers collectively should have a lot of power because they make up a majority of the representation of Conservatives in Parliament. There's only a few of them that are actually promoted to, you know, the front bench, to positions on the cabinet. As I'm saying, MPs who are pissed off with the Prime Minister can write letters to the 1922 committee. It doesn't have to be open, it can be secret, and they can do it whenever they want. But if at one time 15% of them, 15% of Conservative MPs in Parliament write in to say they've had enough, that will trigger a vote of no confidence. And the way it's currently mapped out, because there's quite a few Conservative MPs in Parliament, as we know, 15% of them would amount to 54 people, which is quite a lot. For 54 to have the kind of the gall to go, right, time for somebody else. So that's why initially I kind of thought, oh, I don't know if 54 people will do this. But now as time's going on, I'm like, oh my God, maybe this is going to happen. Because the Guardian was reporting that perhaps as many as 35 had written in. So if that is the case, It's nearly happened, and that's before the report's even come out. Anyway, at that point, say we get to a point where 15% of the Conservative MPs, i.e. 54 of them, write in to the 1922 committee, "I've had enough of Boris Johnson," then we get to a secret ballot. And that is very simple. It's just where every Conservative MP gets to decide, yes or no, do you want to keep Boris Johnson around? Yes or no? And it's a simple majority that Boris Johnson needs, i.e. he needs just over half, one over half, to stay in his position. That would equate to 181 people saying that they're happy with him. And if he does get saved by 181 people or more, then he would be able to avoid any more votes of no confidence for a year. So he'd be safe for a year. It's very brutal. I've got to tell you, the Conservative Party, it's a brutal place to be. You know, it's like a Game of Thrones type of scenario, to be honest. But anyway, if he loses, you know, again, we're talking way in advance now to a point where we're at a secret ballot. If he loses, if he does not get 181 votes of support, then we're into a leadership contest. And that's when, you know, new candidates are going to step up and they have to nominate each other. So one Conservative MP might say, right, I want Rishi Sunak. Can he, you know, can he run? And if, I think it has to be two. If two people nominate Rishi Sunak, which I'm telling you now, plenty more than two would do that, I think, then he'll be on, you know, the ballot for a leadership race. And you tend to get quite a big gaggle of candidates, because if you only need two of your colleagues to put you forward, then you tend to get a big bunch of them, and then it kind of whittles down, as we saw in 2019. Remember, loads of people went for it, and then it ended up being a final race between Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson, and Boris Johnson won it by a landslide. But that is the process. That is the entire process that we might see happen. I don't know, but we might. And it's good that you now kind of know what to expect. You have been through it before. The Tories quite like playing this little game, but we may well see it again this year. I, along with lots of you, have kind of thought for a long time that Boris Johnson is uniquely immune to this sort of thing. Like, he just has this weird Teflon quality where he can make a series of mishaps and the Tories will be kind of bizarrely loyal to him. Uniquely loyal, considering, like I say, the Tories tend to turn on each other quite easily, at least in the past they have. But this seems to be changing the tone. And also, Boris Johnson's ratings in the polls are at an all-time low and Labour are way ahead now, which is new. You know, before the end of last year, that was not a thing. Labour consistently were trailing behind. I don't think that's a reason for Labour to be super excited. I don't think they should be jumping for joy. This is more of a anti-Tory thing than it is a pro-Labour thing, in my view. I don't think people are saying, oh, yay, Labour. I think it's more of a, if there was a snap election tomorrow, I would vote Labour as a way of rejecting the current government because I'm pissed off with them. That's how I'm viewing it. But still, it's affecting Boris Johnson and it might rub off and have, you know, Conservative MPs going, I don't know if I want him anymore. Maybe we should have somebody new. Not to mention the fact, like I say, they can write these letters secretly, which would be more tempting, because if you write a letter and then you come out about it, you are putting your, you're putting your balls on the line, aren't you really? Because then, you know, if you write a letter and they're not quite enough people write in, if you don't quite get 54 people writing in, then Boris Johnson's going to go, well, fuck you. And he's still going to be in power. So you've really put yourself out there. But quite a few people have done that. We've had Roger Gale do that, Conservative MP, William Ragg, Caroline Noakes, Andrew Brigden. So a few people have come out and said, you know what, I'm happy for everyone to know that, you know, I'm up for a vote of no confidence. Do you know who I feel bad for? I feel bad for the Conservative MPs who won the seats in the Red Wall. You know, this area that was traditionally Labour. And some of these seats had literally never, ever been Conservative since they were devised. And then in 2019, some of these places voted Conservative as a bit of a pun, as a bit of something different. Maybe they were excited by Brexit. Maybe they liked Boris Johnson, whatever it was. And this big red wall got knocked down and turned blue, as they say. It turned from Labour to Conservative. Those MPs are already in a precarious position because they're having to daily prove themselves and say to their constituents, you know, thank you for your vote. Thank you for taking a chance on me. I promise I'm going to do right by you. And then these particular people are looking at Boris Johnson going, for God's sake, like, you're putting me in a hell of a position, because if I back you, then my I might lose my integrity with my constituents. But at the same time, these people have a lot to thank Boris Johnson for, because he was, let's be honest, a big reason why the election was so successful for the Conservatives in 2019. A lot of people said, I'm voting Boris Johnson, not I'm voting Conservative. So they have him to thank for their jobs in some ways, but they also have him to be annoyed with because their integrity might be called into question. I do think about the Conservative MPs that are in that position, and I wonder how they're feeling about all of this. Again, I think some of them will be waiting for this report, which will be the perfect excuse to justify their next move. So there you have that. And lots of news over the last 24 hours has been about Boris Johnson's strategy. Like, how am I going to save myself here? Because I'm plummeting in the polls, people aren't happy with me, and certain members of my own party are clearly starting to turn against me. What am I going to do? And I'm hearing talk of something kind of brutal sounding called Operation Dead Meat. I don't know if you've heard about this. It is quite brutal. Basically, it was on the front page of The Eye and The Mirror this morning, at least, maybe a couple more. And it's this alleged plan to basically have a bit of a bloodbath in Downing Street and to just sack a load of aides, sack a load of staff, pin the blame for these parties on them, and then kind of just try and redirect the narrative to say, well, okay, those guys are gone. They were the rule breakers. We're going to change the culture in Downing Street. No more drinking, no more faffing. And by the way, look at all the fabulous things we're doing. And, you know, there's talk of this NHS war room that they're creating where they're going to try and focus on sorting the NHS. There's also talks about, you know, obviously the Conservatives, one of their big pledges in their 2019 manifesto was to clamp down on migration numbers. Easier said than done is something we've learned over the last couple of years. But there's reports that they're going to go hell for leather in trying to prove to the public that they can do that. Not 100% confirmed. This is just rumours. This is just discussion of a potential plan. But it gives you a flavour of the kind of, ruthless Machiavellian streak that you would need to have to work in political PR. If people are sitting in a room going, right, who should we sack? There is also, by the way, a conversation underway about the BBC. You've probably heard about this, and I think it will explode into quite a big debate. The Culture Secretary, her name is Nadine Dorries. She is so critical about the BBC. The reason she's critical of it is because she believes it has a left-wing bias and, what's more, a vendetta against the Prime Minister. That's something that she feels and that she kind of seems to perceive. Johnson's allies, including Nadine Dorries, have sort of been saying that the BBC have been hammering this Partygate stuff too much. They've been focused too much on it in such a way that it's now making them feel like they've got an agenda to get rid of him. This idea, like, they're just not going to stop until Boris Johnson steps down. That being said, Johnson's critics, or I suppose just supporters of the BBC, are saying you can't just say that the BBC are biased when they report on stuff you don't like. Just because you don't like what they're saying doesn't necessarily mean that they have a vendetta against you. It might mean that you've done something wrong. So it kind of depends where you fall on that. And one thing I will say is that the BBC are sort of consistently caught in the crossfire, with people on the right saying that it's too left and people on the left saying that it's too right. And usually, and I've done work within the BBC before, you know, BBC staff will joke that if you get an equal proportion of these complaints, then they're doing their job right. And they are probably being impartial and people are just pissed off about that. But to a large degree, even though it is a free and separate press in the sense that the government doesn't control it, it still relies on the government to keep renewing their contract, keep renewing their licence fee charter. So this is the charter is basically the funding system that we currently use to keep the BBC going. And forgive me if this is a bit patronising. If you're a UK listener, you will be well aware of this because you'll probably have to pay 160 quid a year. But if you're not, I want to get you squared up on this because it's quite an interesting model that we use here. Basically, if you buy a TV, you kind of have to buy a licence fee. You like shouldn't really be watching TV at all unless you have a licence fee. It's an interesting thing that we do. And that licence fee is about 160 quid a year, I think just less than 160 quid a year. And of course, us paying for it means that it's not trying to have to find profit because we're already paying for it. So that means it's not worried about profit, and therefore it's not trying to win audiences by appealing to their sensibilities. So it can maintain its impartiality in that sense. Now, you might be listening to this thinking, that all sounds good, but the BBC doesn't do that. And that's up to you. If you don't think the BBC is impartial, absolutely, you know, I can't tell you how to feel on that. Nadine Dorris is one person who would agree with you. She doesn't believe it's doing its job well enough at all. And this is what she tweeted this week. This licence fee announcement will be the last. The days of the elderly being threatened with prison sentences and bailiffs knocking on doors are over. It's time now to discuss and debate new ways of funding, supporting and selling great British content. So this is her saying, look, we've got this current charter, this current contract where we're all going to be paying a licence fee. That lasts until 2027 because they're 10-year contracts and the last one was updated in 2017. But after that, no more. The BBC is going to have to do something else. I think Doris is sort of suggesting that it might have to be a like Netflix, literally, like a subscription service. Other people are saying, well, we should have it as a council tax. Other people are saying that the BBC should just stop existing. And you know, people that hate it are saying that. The only thing about this, of course, is the timing. Like, this has all come out now at the same time as Boris Johnson, you know, is grappling to keep control of his party. And I suppose the heaviest critics are also saying, like, she is trying to get people to think that all this Partygate stuff isn't that bad, and the BBC are making it sound worse than it is. One thing I'll say on this, you know, it's so divisive, and I put it on Instagram, and, you know, people were already getting pissed off just at me talking about it. But one thing I will say is that I really hope this doesn't go to a referendum. That's just my own, like, from one broken political commentator to you, I hope this doesn't go to a referendum. I saw in the Daily Mail, it was reported yesterday, that supposedly 2/3 of voters want a referendum on axing the BBC, as they put it. Let's not do that. From experience, I and we can all say that referendums do an awful lot to divide society. And do they improve society? I don't know. I think dividing is more of a focus than improving. And if you put something to a referendum, you, in my view, you get a binary choice. You end up getting binary options, which tend to move further and further away from each other. Like, they get more and more extreme because people get really upset and really political about it, naturally, because this tends to get quite toxic. And I'm speaking from experience here, right? As we all can. So when you get binary choices, you end up losing a nuanced, obsessed with that word, you know I'm obsessed with that word, a nuanced compromise in the middle. This concept dies in the face of a referendum. And the idea of a mutually beneficial arrangement becomes but a pipe dream. And look, if you think I'm being dramatic, I have one word for you. Also a B word, like the BBC. Also, you know, an old and admittedly flawed institution that we debated axing. And that's Brexit. Why would we want that toxicity again? I'm not saying that we shouldn't have left the EU. I think, you know, we all have our own opinions on that. And that topic had merit. But the way we went about leaving the EU sucked. I don't know if there's many people that say, oh, do you know what was fun? Was the EU referendum period of time. Why don't we do that again? Okay, that ended up turning into a bit of a kind of anti-referendum rant, which I wasn't quite expecting, but there's still lots to mull over in this episode, lots of interconnected issues, and lots of you have asked me who might replace Boris Johnson if we get to that point. And like I say, there's multiple hurdles in the way of that scenario materialising, and I did write a piece exclusively on Patreon about that. And what I did was I outlined the key contenders, and then I shared whether I thought they even wanted the job. I checked out their odds on betting websites, and I gave a rundown of their background and their political leanings. So check it out on Patreon. The link is in the episode description. And if you become a patron, you are, of course, supporting this podcast. You're keeping it going. And with that, I'm going to leave you there. Make sure you get in touch with me if you've got thoughts about this. Be nice, though. I've had enough of people being horrible. My handle is @JuliaBell_X on both Instagram and Twitter. And I'll ask you this. Have you considered what you want to happen? And I'm not just talking about the short term. Think about this like a game of chess, because that's what politics is. Think 5 moves ahead. If you're one of these people that wants Boris Johnson to go, fine, but who would you want to succeed him? Because somebody has to. And you have to think about the most likely outcomes, and you have to think about whether you'd be happy with that. I hope you have a positive week, whatever you're doing. Take care. Thank you for listening. And I'll speak to you in the next one. Okay, goodbye.